Peace. My name is Ali. I'm from Minneapolis, Minnesota. I'm an albino, not the Kentucky Fried Chicken man. Or Santa Claus. People always, growing up, they would call me Santa Claus or the Kentucky Fried Chicken man. But joke's on you, because everybody likes chicken and presents.
Yo, welcome.
My man.
Yo, we on season 3 of the Educated Guest Podcast.
Season kickoff with your man's brother Ali.
Man, they're not ready for it, bro. I wasn't ready for it.
I don't think anybody was ready for it.
I had such a good time making this episode, well, basically editing this episode. You know, you listen to people's words over and over again when you're editing, but it just never got old.
It's so dope, dude. I mean, it was a remarkable experience being there live. But to be able to share this with all y'all, this is going to be great, dude. I'm excited.
Yo, this episode is going to be brought to you in 2 pieces. I got a private interview with Brother Ali. And then after that, we were part of a pre-conference at Boost 2018. Right. And the pre-conference was titled Love, Heal, Grow. And I think I did some stellar editing for y'all. He's got some powerful stories that are just for educators. You got to listen up.
Yeah. It was dope, man. I'm really excited to see or to hear what the response is from everybody, because hopefully there's some gems that everybody will be able to take away from. You know, it's brother Ali's just a master storyteller, bro. You know, and it's evident. And so I hope you enjoy it, man.
So, a special shout out to one of the unofficial producers of the Educated Guest Podcast, your brother and my dear friend, Diego Arancibia. If it were not for him, this episode doesn't happen.
Correct.
We love you, bro.
This is dope.
All right. So we're going to drop right into my interview with him. It's a short one. It's a good one. I tried my best to not fan out, and I wanted to ask him. I just wanted to ask him some deep questions. We hit hip hop. We hit education. You ready for this?
Let's do it.
All right. Real quick. My introduction to hip-hop was I was about 13 years old, junior high, and my buddy brought me this tape, and it said Boogie Down Productions. You remember the first tape? Criminal Minded.
Absolutely.
You've been blinded. Tell me a little, and it just, hip-hop had me from there.
Mm.
Tell me a little bit about your introduction to hip-hop and when you knew you loved it.
Well, I think that it's been phases and stages, and it's grown, you know mm-hmm. what I mean? It's kind of like, when did you know you love your mom? Like you kind of always know it. And then you have just different realizations. And then even after she passes away, you still have new, levels and openings of like love and appreciation and gratitude. And you know what I'm saying? Cause mm-hmm. like relationships are like that. So, the first time, I don't have a first memory kind of thing, but I know that I really loved Houdini, and I really loved Run DMC, mm-hmm. and I really loved UTFO, mm-hmm. and like most of the stuff that I heard was on compilation cassettes in the 80s, because it was difficult to find albums. I wasn't really connected. I was in the Midwest. I wasn't really connected to a lot of DJs that could, you know, make me the great mixtapes or bring them from New York or something like that. Mm-hmm. So it'd be like, you know, Ultimate Rap or Hip Rap Gold or something like that. Different compilations that were put out.
Right.
That's where I really, you know, was able to study. And then in the late 80s, when Boogie Down Productions came out, Public Enemy came out, Rakim came out, that's when I started to realize that I was fully hooked. And that's when you could buy an album, a body of work of somebody like KRS-One mm-hmm. or Rakim. Mm-hmm. And that's when I knew that, like, this is changing my life. This is not just a fun thing that I do. Mm-hmm. Like, I live my life. I'm ever conscious of what hip hop is informing me. Like when I was, you know, at that time I was 13, same age probably. And I was really like, the way that I walk and the way that I present and the way that I analyze things and the way that I talk to people and the things that I would advocate for. And, you know, even if I wasn't reading books yet, I was like walking around holding them, cause I was like, this is what KRS would read, or like, this is what Chuck D would read. Mm. You know, I wanted to be a powerful, smart, virtuous, you know, person. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be an instrument of justice. I wanted to be dope. I wanted to, you know. Right. So yeah, that was all. I would say 13 is when it really changed who I am as a person.
Very nice. Very nice. So I'm going to ask you a real huge question that I believe most people can only just take kind of chips at. What can education learn from hip hop?
Mm. Well, first of all, you know, hip hop, it has a continuity between generations. So all of the beauty of, you know, the hip hop production is in reimagining and incorporating the music before, as you know. So mm-hmm. on the East Coast, you got sampling a lot of James Brown and Sly and the Family Stone. On the West Coast, you got sampling a lot of, you know, George Clinton and Bootsy Collins and people from that tree. Mm-hmm. And they're incorporating it all in a way that pays a lot of respect to it, in a way that says, like, these OGs really knew what was going on. Mm-hmm. And our elders and our ancestors, like, really knew something. And of course, those traditions all borrow from the traditions before them. So, you know, funk comes from, you know, jazz and blues, and from R&B, and R&B comes directly from, you know, gospel, and, you know, jazz comes directly from blues, and all of them come from spirituals, and all of that comes from the griot traditions in West Africa. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
All back on through time. So one of the main things that I think educators in the West and in a modern context have a problem with is, like, we're not speaking the same language as the kids are. But, you know, in more traditional cultures, and even in, like, the Black American tradition, if you go to, like, a Black American family reunion or graduation party, all of the generations are there. Music is playing a big role. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you put on a Commodore's song, or when you put on a really good Ohio Player song, mm-hmm. the 13-year-olds, like, they know that that's dope, and they can, like, groove to it, and they're like, oh yeah, the oldies, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But if you put on a Kendrick Lamar song, the elders, they know how to, like, their body knows how to move to it, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? So there is continuity there that, like, that is really something to be learned and something to be admired, you know. I think that hip hop also honors people's creativity and ingenuity and, like, having their own voice and things like that, like all of the obvious things. But, you know, really, hip hop is the soul knowing that it possesses beauty and desires to be surrounded by beauty. And so regardless of the ugliness, like, you know, ugliness is the deprivation of beauty. So if we're fasting, then we're really aware. Like, I'm Muslim, so we fast every Ramadan. Mm-hmm. And you're really aware of all the food you're not eating right now. You know what I mean? Like, you're hungry and you're like, you start thinking about food you never thought of, or you hadn't thought of in years. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
You start being like, man, fried green tomatoes would really, you know what I'm saying? Or whatever it is. And so the deprivation of beauty actually sparks the hunger for beauty. And in those really, you know, outwardly, physically, and spiritually and psychically, like, ugly environments, people discovered ways to create, reflect, express, and produce beauty through those art forms. And that's really what they are. So you have, like, people who don't have musical instruments learning to play recorded music as a musical instrument. People who, you know, don't have access to be in a choir in school and things like that. And, you know, maybe aren't able to go to church all the time and things like that. Learning to write songs and learning to tell stories and all of that, you know. And then people who, you know, live in these really outwardly ugly areas, you know, without access to art studios and things like that, and, you know, really being taught and training each other.
Right, right, right.
So, like, I know you already know, but, like, if you watch, like, Style Wars, you know, and you see, like, Kay Slay as a teenager, and he's got, like, so he's, like, 13. And then, but he's mentoring a 9-year-old. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's, like, a generation in between them. So he's like, he's already really good, and he's going to be much more gooder in a couple years. You know what I mean?
Right.
And then they got a 17-year-old Case that they look up to.
Right.
And he's like, I'm the ambassador of style and all that stuff. You know what I mean?
I know what you mean.
So, you know, these guys rename themselves, first of all. Mm-hmm. And then they write their names, and it's extraordinarily beautiful. But then also that travels all over the city on the trains, that genius. And so if somebody on the Upper East Side, or the Upper West Side, I'm sorry, you know, where everybody has a lot of money, they see the train go by and they know that's a train from the Bronx or from Harlem that goes through their neighborhood. And like some 16-year-old genius did that. And I have to wrestle with the fact that this person has all of this going on inside their soul. Mm. I can't just say, well, they're poor because they're not trying or they're, you know.
Right.
And then also you put in that the element of dance, like movement. You know, people like, you know, bringing all the traditions from, you know, Brazil and Africa and all, and Puerto Rico and all those, and learning how to dance, developing a way to dance on concrete without getting dirty.
Right.
No dance studio. There's not a big mirror. There's not a place to stretch and warm up.
No formal training.
No training. But they trained each other, though. Yeah,
they did.
They always trained each other. So, you know, one of my OGs is Pop Master Fable from the Rocksteady crew.
Okay.
And he'll say, I was a shorty in the crew, you know, whereas like the older guys were teaching me, you know. And so there is an idea, like hip hop has all of that in it. And if we're not seeing it, it's because we don't honor it enough to actually learn.
That's awesome. You took a real big chunk out of that question. I like that. You touched on something that's really important to me and is important to the people that are here at this conference. We had the Boost Conference 2018, and that's mentorship. What has mentorship meant to you? And who are some of your big mentors in your life? I already know the answer to this question. But I just want to hear it.
Yeah, well, I've been really blessed that like a lot of the people that I listen to and watch, and my heart really connects with them. Mm-hmm. Like I know and believe that the Creator brings me to those people, and so the first one of them was KRS-One,
word,
who brought me on stage when I was 13,
the teacher,
yeah, told me to read the autobiography of Malcolm X, and then you know, so I'll start with the names. So then there's another one that's a little bit, you know, known in the Muslim world, but the son of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, Imam Warithdin Muhammad, is the one who basically, you know, helped evolve the Nation of Islam into a more traditionally recognized expression of Islam. Okay. That's still very American and still very black and still very modern. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he basically like rerouted the Nation of Islam in the theology of Islam. So he was one. And then, you know, Chuck D has become a really important mentor to me. Mm-hmm. Slug from a group called Atmosphere is probably my most active mentor in terms of music. But Rakim took me on tour for a year.
Word.
Yeah. And I was on his bus with his family and, you know, things like that.
With Eric B or without Eric B?
This was before he got back with Eric
B.
Yeah. So this is 2006 and seven.
Okay.
Also, Brand Nubian took me on tour.
Oh, what?
Ghostface Killah took me on tour. The GZA took me on tour. Who are some of the others? Big Daddy Kane has been really good to me. Mm. So a lot of the people that I grew up loving, listening to, have really been supportive, you know. Mm-hmm. Some of the ones that aren't as well known are, you know, there's a person in Minneapolis named Imam Matthew Ramadan, who was my first teacher, like direct teacher when I became Muslim. And he had a rites of passage program that he put young men through, where, you know, you had to be prepared, like everybody had to be able to lead in every regard. So we took self-defense classes so that we could be security guards for the women in our community. And then, you know, we learned some financial stuff, like basic how to balance a budget, checks, book, things like that.
Word.
We learned how to wear a suit, how to tie a tie. We learned how to slaughter animals, like we for our food.
Oh, wow.
So we sacrificed animals. Also, each of us were assigned to an elder, and we had to go and see them in person once a week, and we had to call them two other times per week and then report back for how they're doing and are they eating and is their space clean and what's their state, what condition are they in.
That's and, really beautiful.
Yeah. And then when they die, Muslims, we don't send people to the morgue to be embalmed. Like we wash our community members. Mm-hmm. We wash them. We put fragrance on them. We wrap them in two pieces of cloth, and then we bury them with our own hands.
Wow.
And so that elder that we were assigned to, when that person dies, you're you lead the washing, the you know, wrapping, the burial, the whole thing.
That's a beautiful process.
Yeah. So that's something that I went through, you know, as a 15-year-old.
So your relationship with your mentors, what's that back and forth like? Or is there even a back and forth? Because, you know, I know the relationship a lot of times between teacher and student is like, the student doesn't often challenge the teacher or say, hey, this concept doesn't make sense to me. Do you have a relationship with any of your mentors like that, where you actually push ideas back and forth?
I'm not really in a space of like challenging them, because like the reason that they're my teacher is because I'm very happy, impressed, and in love with them just how they are. I like that. I don't take everything for myself, though. Like, not everything's for me. Mm. And it's not because I think I'm better or I think I'm right and they're wrong. It's just that we're not the same people. And so there are certain things that apply to them that just don't apply to me. Mm. But, you know, I think we all really like curate and make our own relationships with our teachers based on the questions we ask and the way that we present ourselves to them. And, you know, so I have some teachers that are very formal and like, it's a very formal relationship, you know, and then I have other ones that are really informal. I might tease some of them a little bit. Yeah. There are some of them that I started off really formal and I didn't know if they liked me or not. And then I kind of made a little, I took a little like stab at one of them one time as a joke. Oh. And he like completely just like fell in love with me after that. And so now, you know, when I used to text him, it would be very formal. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, peace, light, and good morning, sir. I pray that all is well with you. I just wanted to check in with you, you know, and there are certain like Arabic terms that I would speak to them with, but basically saying like, oh, master, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Ya Maulana Kareem, like, oh, like, you know, noble master of ours.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like this kind of language. And, you know, he made a statement in public one time that people really disagreed with. It's about a, you know, a topic that really is close to my heart, which is like racial justice. Mm-hmm. And he's a European American man. And he took a lot of heat for it. And I felt really like defensive of him because I felt like he misspoke. I don't feel like he was actually, like people were really speaking to his real way of living.
Okay.
And, you know, so I sat with him and he's very majestic, you know, and can really be hard on people. And he said, you know, he's like, I'm just wrong. It's no big, like, I'm just wrong.
Yeah.
Like, you're not on a spiritual journey if you don't, but he's like, it's also what I think. Mm. So I'm aware that I think something that everyone says is wrong. So I'm probably wrong. But if you ask me what I think, I have to tell you what I think. Yeah. They asked him in an interview, you know. And I was like, you know, can I say something that you don't come across as a person who really considers the idea of yourself being wrong? You know what I mean? And he looked at me kind of weird and then he just cracked up laughing. And then he was just like kind of boxing with me and like, you know, kind of like fake punching me and stuff. And that now I said, okay, let me see if I text him a different way. So I texted him and I was just like, hey, assalamu alaikum, pray you're well. Love you, man. Like L-O-L-U-V-Y-A-M-A-N. Love you, man.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he texted me, love back. How so-and-so, you know what I mean? And like, it just changed our whole relationship where I think he was maybe waiting for me, you know, because like really good teachers, it's about teaching you. It's not about what they want to do. It's about what you need, you know? So I realized like when I was approaching him as a child, he was treating me like a child. And then once I, you know, once I kind of leveled up a little bit, then he leveled up with me, but it's still very clear that he's the teacher.
Understood. Understood. You talked a little bit about yesterday how you felt that the industry kind of imprisons you.
Mm.
Could you, the music industry?
I wasn't even talking about the industry.
Oh, word?
No, and that's it's interesting. Like one of the other brothers thought the same thing, but I was talking about you know, the fact that I make music as something that I love, and when I have something I want to express, and when I feel inspired. You know, and then, and you say, I wish I could just make a living at this. Mm-hmm. And then you get to a point where you make a living at it. I've been making a living at it for 15 years. And now I'm in a place where I have to make music. And, you know, it can just like anything that we're dreaming about can become a prison. And I think we just don't always realize that, you know.
Your music, it's like you don't take any breaks from being deeply personal, and you rhyme about a lot of powerful experiences. One time you rhymed about the loss of one of your mentors. You rhyme about your son. How is that process? I mean, is it difficult to go from something so either painful or deep and then putting that on wax? I mean, what's that process like?
Yeah, well, I basically feel like it's interesting. Like, my first album that I ever made is about to be, it's the 15-year anniversary of it. So I listened to it and I did an interview where, you know, like, I talked a lot about it. Mm-hmm. And I listened to it and I'm like, there are times on there where I'm not telling first person stories of my own life. Mm-hmm. Which is something I won't ever do that again. Like, I'll never tell somebody else's story, you know. Mm-hmm. I tell my own stories. Mm-hmm. But also, like, I was so much more free. And, like, there's so much more, like, funny, like, humorous, like, that side of me is in the music a lot more. Uh-huh. So I think when I made the transition to, like, I will never make music that's not intensely personal to me. Like, whatever is most important in my heart, that's what the music's going to be about. And on the one hand, I think that overall that's been really good. On the other hand, I'm like, man, I'm not as free as I used to be. Ooh. And I'm not funny. Ooh. Like, I stopped being funny. So, you know, there's always kind of a balance there. But, and then also, sometimes in sharing, like, I'm not an island. So, you know, when I tell my stories, they inevitably include a lot of other people. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So, like, I made all these songs for my son, but, you know, now my son makes music and he's like, if anybody ever finds out that I'm the guy that these songs are about, I've basically released music without ever choosing it. Like, mm-hmm. you've kind of told the world things about me that I don't know if I would have chose to tell.
Oh.
I did that when he was 4 years old, you know what I'm saying? And now he's 18.
Yeah, yeah.
And he makes music and he might be in the public eye someday. You know what I mean? So that's the kind of thing that, like, I never really thought about that. Mm-hmm.
Just to wrap it up,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to talk about the effect of your music. Something happened yesterday before your session, and that was the sound man is a big fan. Mm-hmm. So he calls his wife up, and his wife too. He mm-hmm. calls his wife and says, you won't believe this. Brother Ali is here.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, I'm going to be there right now. She's mm-hmm. at work.
Yeah.
She tells her boss, I'm going to take my lunch right now. I'll be mm-hmm. back.
Mm-hmm.
And she came down and she was the young lady that brought you the coffee.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I didn't think much of it in the sense that an artist such as yourself probably sees a lot of fans in that manner, right? But as she's walking out, she's crying.
Mm-hmm.
And it got me, like, I got emotional.
Mm-hmm.
And so I asked her husband, sound guy, I said, hey, I said, wow, she's really emotional about meeting Brother Ali. And he goes, you don't understand. We're really, really big fans.
Mm.
And if we're having a bad day, we put on his music and things get better.
Yeah. And we have struggles in common. So, like, they have a child that has special needs.
Mm.
And, you know, they're like, we have a lot of things in common.
Does it ever just overwhelm you just to hear how powerful your music is? I mean, does it get, I don't know, man, that just really hit me.
Well,
hard.
This is where, like, so I've learned a lot from my spiritual masters about that.
Mm.
You know, because they change people's lives. You know what I'm saying? Like, I mean, you're talking about, you know, I changed my name
mm-hmm.
and became a Muslim.
Yeah.
And, you know, married a woman and had children and had to deal with that with my parents. And, like, you know, I've essentially, you know, my whole identity and life has changed because of what these men and women give us, you know. And as I've been blessed to get close to them, and they've become my mentors too. So, you know, those people, what I see in them is that they're really aware that they're not the ones doing anything. They're in a role. It's, you know, the creator is doing all of it.
Mm.
The, you know, God, the creator is doing it all. Like, and we're, you know, we're just instruments in it. And so what we do is we strive to really honor our role in it, whatever our role is, you know. So, you know, for teachers, you know, like a teacher knows, like, I'm not the one actually teaching, mm-hmm. you know, I'm just kind of holding the door to knowledge open and welcoming the kid, you know, and loving the kid. And that's it. You know, I'm not actually teaching them anything.
Right.
Real teachers know that.
The real teachers. Yeah. Good ones.
Right. Yeah. And of course, you know, there's people that do everything for the wrong reasons. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's no, you know, and the things that are considered to be the most special attract a lot of people that just want access to that power, you know. But the idea is to do it as worship, you know. And some people, the word worship is like, do you mean, you know, my grandma's religion, which I had a bad experience in, and, you know, maybe, you know, not necessarily, but the idea of like serving the real embodiment of love and light and goodness, mm-hmm. you know, like a lot of us will say that we're atheists, but then we talk about the universe, you know, the universe gives you, if you put good in the universe gives you good back. Okay. Well, what you say is the universe, I say is God.
Word.
But, you know, if you've been shown a picture of God as a white man in a chair damning people to hell, and then, like, I don't believe in the God that you don't believe in, too. So right. if that's, you know, I've also been very fortunate to be given an articulation of God that I believe is universal and real for everybody. And I don't need other people to have that same framework or language or whatever. But so when I say worship, it's like, I'm here to serve the force of everything good, you know, that ever is, you know. And when we do that, we're aware that we're an instrument. Mm-hmm. And so we just try to be a good conduit, a good instrument. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like if I'm literally, you know, if I'm a screw in the sign that holds the sign on the signpost or on the wall or something like that, I just want to be a good screw. You know what I mean? Like, let me just, you know.
Understood. Yeah. When I listen to your podcast, when I listen to that you've done before, when I've listened to your music, and ultimately the presentation that you did yesterday, Love, Heal, Grow with Mark Gonzalez, that beauty inside of you shines through, and that love that you're talking about, that worship that you're talking about, it shines through. And I appreciate you sharing your time, your voice, and your ideas with us here on the podcast.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure, man. Thank you, brother.
Yes, this is Brother Ali, a noble servant of the people who inspires us to love, heal, and grow. The people's champ whose beauty shines through in his humility and authenticity every time he greets you. Whether it's the first time or multiple times, the champ will greet and ask you how you've been, not where you've been. See, this is a brother who engages daily in the hard work of heart work, who reminds us we love to fight because we fight for love, and who reminds us that our ancestors are more alive than us. These are the reminders that are needed in these times. Let this serve as an anthem to our warriors and our healers, the brothers and sisters doing the work in the schoolyard, in the classroom, in the fields. Now is not the time to be timid, as my dear brother Mark Gonzalez states. May we honor our ancestors. May our descendants be nobled and blessed. May the compassionate one preserve you, your talents and gifts. May the gentle one be gentle with you. May the loving one love you. And may the people's champ remain undefeated. I mean, plus, a lot of these cats, they too ugly to be champ. Peace. Peace.
So albinism is a condition that affects your skin, hair, and eyes. You don't have the color that you normally would have. Also, we're partially blind. I'm legally blind. I can't see much past the end of my hands. So the good news is, if you fall asleep or start texting or leave, I won't even see you. The bad news is, if you try to tell me, if you're trying to communicate something to me physically, I'm not going to see it. So if anybody has something that you want to add, such as stop now, or something you want to, you know, say, or something like that, I needed to be audible, if that's all right. You know, I grew up speaking mostly to black audiences and being in like black spaces. And black, it's really good if you can't see very well because black people talk to you and you know how well it's going and you know how, what they're experiencing. And so snapping is kind of new for me, you know, because I grew up just like, yes, you know what I mean? Or say that, yeah, make it plain, da, 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 you know, all of those kind of things. And so when audiences are quiet, I'm just like, I think they all left. You know, which is actually cool because I'm like, all right, now I just say whatever the hell my secrets are. I just say whatever I want. The other thing is that, you know, the sun is a really difficult thing for people who have albinism because you can get a sunburn really easily. Also, if there's any light at all, it's extremely, feels very, very bright. And, you know, so all of these things were things I grew up as a kid. My parents, my father is European American guy. My mother, we believe, is the same, although she was adopted, so we don't know. When I was a little kid, I grew up in the Midwest in the 80s. In little cities, we moved almost every year to different little cities throughout Michigan. And most of these communities had, you know, they were almost major, they were almost entirely white. There were small communities of, there would be like a very small population of black families. And then there would be like maybe one Asian family who had to represent for all Asians everywhere. And there would be like one Mexican family who did the same thing. And actually, they were probably Guatemalan or something, but they were Mexican to us. At one of the schools I had, we had two Joes. We had Chinese Joe and Fat Joe. Chinese Joe was actually Vietnamese. And Fat Joe, his name was actually Joel. But it was he was Fat Joe and Chinese Joe. But at one of these places, you know, I was, I went to school the first day and, you know, show up in school looking very different and also can't see and also can't move very well. I get lost when I walk around in places because of the visual landmarks and stuff like that. I just don't, can't see those and, you know, can't do sports and all these kind of things. And I walked in on the first day of school in second grade, I was 7 years old. And somebody said, why does he look like that? And what, you know, why is he moving like that? And, you know, it was the beginning of the discussion. And some expert just announced to everybody, it's because he has AIDS. And, you know, this is the 80s. Like, we didn't really know what AIDS was yet. It's kind of like the beginning of fake news, where one person who just sounds like an expert to everybody else is like, he has AIDS. And I was already into hip-hop music, so I had an Adidas shirt on, and somebody said, his shirt even says AIDS. And so that became the truth, because everybody believed it. And it really wasn't, I don't think it was intentionally meant to be that cruel, but somebody needed to come up with an answer, and so they announced one to everybody. And so my name for the entire school year was AIDS. And I didn't realize what a horrible thing that was until I was lost in the hallway one day and a teacher who didn't really know me that well was trying to help me. And she said, hey, she couldn't remember my name. She was like, hey, AIDS, if you go to the so-and-so, and I saw her catch herself and I saw the horror on her face. Like, I should never say that to him. In fact, she had thought about it before that, like, never say that. And I realized how horrible it was. So my mom, the following year, we were going to leave. And one of the things that I took away from that is that it doesn't have to be everybody that's cruel to you. If the most vocal people are cruel and nobody is equally vocal in standing up for you, then it might as well be the entire class or the entire society or the entire nation. Or it might as well be the whole world. And so we switched schools that year, and my mother had the idea that we're going to dye your hair when we change schools. Nobody at the new school knows you're an albino. And this was a woman who I believe is probably Eastern European. She was a dark, complected woman, had dark hair, but she was adopted by a Norwegian family. So she had dyed her hair at some point to fit in with her adopted family. And so to her, this was a great solution. So we're going to dye your hair, and you'll go to school, and nobody will know you're albino. We'll get you some tinted glasses. And, you know, you just don't move around too much so nobody sees you trip over stuff. And you can pass. So we went to a salon, a cheap one. And I sat in the chair and they put some stuff in my hair that smelled like death.
the idea is we're going to dye your hair blonde. So we sit in a chair and they put this stuff in my hair. And hair dye works with the color that's already in your hair. It attaches to the color that's in your hair. So since I didn't have any, it turned my hair purple, which isn't better than white if you're trying to blend in. And so this didn't work. So I go home and like, damn it. Like now this, I'm worse than I was when I started. Before I looked like Phil Donahue. Now I'm just out here looking like David Bowie or something, buddy. You know what I'm saying? So we eventually had to go to the expensive salon. I remember my mom and dad having an argument because we didn't have money. Like we had, you know, we used to get cheese from the government and stuff like that. We didn't have money. And they had already spent $23 or something like that on the cheap one. The expensive one's going to be like 70 bucks. So that's not cool. But my mother is like, he needs to make it. He needs a chance. And they had a big argument and she suffered a lot. And so she took me to this place and I sat in the chair and this woman whipped up a special concoction, put it in my hair and, you know, sat it in there. And I had this moment where they took the towel off my head and I look in the mirror and it's me, but it's blonde hair. And then also anybody that has some gray hair knows that gray hair doesn't behave the way that your natural color hair does. Your natural color hair has a wave or a curl or something like that. Gray hair just completely does whatever the hell it wants to do. Much like elders, because it's like, you know what? Let's cut through all the stuff right now and let's just do what we need to do. So my hair on my head grows the same way as the hair on my beard. It's just straight out. So I had to sit and this woman taught me how to hold hairspray called Aquanet. I got some witnesses for Aquanet. So I sat there and with a comb and Aquanet and sprayed this thick layer of cakey stuff that would lay my hair down straight. It was like I had a helmet on when I got done. And if it gets wet, you can forget it. So I sat there and laid it down, comb it, part it first, comb it, spray it. Lay it, sprayed and laid. It's like fried and dyed, laid to the side. But it's sprayed and laid. It's what European people do when they're trying to get their change their stuff up. So lay it, spray it and lay it. I just made that up. We're going to keep that one. I wish I could write it down. Sprayed and laid. So lay it down. And by the time we got done, I was like ready to pass as a normal white boy in school. And I'm thinking like, this might be all right. I didn't recognize myself in the mirror, but I think this might be okay. What I learned after that is that it's not, you can't just do this once because the hair that grows out of my head will reveal my secret. And so you have to go back and do this every 2 weeks or something like that. Because the hair that naturally grows out of me is the problem. And over the course of that school year, I grew incredibly depressed because what my mother had done without realizing it is communicate to me that the way to interact and confront this group of people who are dehumanizing, demoralizing you is to actually sign up for their program and change your physical appearance to be more acceptable to them and to actually disguise yourself to look like them, to put their uniform on, because that's what she had done. And it worked out well for her. But for me, it wasn't that way.
I think we need a break.
heavy duty stuff. And I think, you know, if I can put myself back in that space of listening to Brother Ali in live, like, you know, people in the audience were getting emotional because we've all identified with that.
Absolutely.
That feeling of being ostracized, marginalized, outcast. In a lot of ways, that's similar to the immigrant experience. You know what I'm saying?
Knowing you look different.
Yeah.
Knowing people could be looking at you.
Yeah. Yeah, or do look at you and overtly say stuff. And, you know, it's tough, man. It's tough. That's why I think everybody was like really, really into it and really emotional about that piece. But as educators, we need to be cognizant of that and create safe spaces for our young people and for our adults to be different, to be unique and be accepting. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. While we may see a student that looks completely cool, calm and normal, inside they could be going through some kind of identity struggle.
Absolutely.
And we got to be cognizant of that.
Yeah.
So as we head into this next segment with Brother Ali, he talks about how just one adult on campus can make a difference for a child. Such an important idea.
Absolutely. And there's tons of research out there that shows it, that all it takes is one adult to build a relationship with a student, and that student will not drop out.
So here we go. Listen up, Brother Ali.
Enjoy it.
We had a woman that worked at our school, and we talk about educating. When I was a kid in the 80s, and there was a huge population, both overwhelmingly white and just a small population of black kids, there was an understanding that we're never going to serve and really educate and love these kids based on what they need. So rather than hire teachers that share their experience and their language and all this stuff, we're going to hire one black person whose job is to do whatever seemingly menial task we give them, but really their job is to just keep the black kids tame while we teach the white kids and just keep them quiet and out of our way. And so in my school, it was the lunch lady. And she ended up being the person that saved my life because she sat with me. I sat by myself every day. And so she would come and sit with me. And over the course of the year, she taught me using music because she knew that I love music. So first she introduced, and she understood the connection between music and hair because she knew she could see. So everybody else knew there's something not quite right. Anytime you try to put on a mask that's not really you, you might fool yourself, but you're not really fooling anybody else. Like everybody knows that like you're trying to look like something and you're not really pulling it off. So she sat with me and she said, you're really into music, huh? You like Elvis Presley? I said, I don't know, maybe. And she said, no, Elvis is good. He's good. We should listen to Elvis Presley. So she gave me some Elvis Presley. And she said, you know, he can almost do it just like us. And she said, you know, a lot of people, they learn to mimic the outward form of black music. And she said, to white people, he sounds better than us at what we do. And so think about like the things that she's teaching on a heart level. She didn't sit me down and say, I know what you really are, and you should stop trying to pretend to be with something that you're not. And you should just really let yourself be yourself. She could have hit me with that, and she would have been right, but I don't know if my heart ever would have arrived at the truth of that. Because she's not teaching the content, she's teaching the person. And so, as our brother Mark says, so she says, Elvis can do it almost just like us. And she said, but look at all the white kids. And she said, he looks cool. And I said, yeah, he looks cool. She said, look at all the white kids in the school. Does his hair look like anybody's hair inside the school? I said, no, nobody's hair does that thing. She said, why do you think his hair looks like that? I said, I don't know, he's trying to be cool, the pompadour. She said, he's trying to make his hair look like a blues musician called Muddy Waters. I never heard of Muddy Waters. So she shows me Muddy Waters, gives me a Muddy Waters record to listen to. It was actually a cassette tape. And Muddy Waters is on the front with that whooped up process that he had. And then, but I get home with the music, so I'm looking at the picture and I'm listening to the music. Mannish boy, can't be satisfied. You know, 19 years old, got ways like a baby child, all this stuff, Muddy Waters. So not only is she introducing me to like where this music really comes from, she said Elvis didn't want to steal our music. He wanted to be down. And it was the people around him that turned him into a thief. And that's part of why he went crazy, because he wasn't his intention to steal something. But the business around entertainment that reduces everything that comes out of our soul into a viable, sellable product, that reduces something that's part of the ancestral nature and heritage of the human being that's connected through lines of lineage, through elders and through ancestors, to something that naturally births out of us. And that really is the voice of God. That we'll take that thing, and we've gotten used to the idea that maybe we don't own black people anymore, but still try to own everything that comes out of them, right? So Elvis didn't want that. He wanted to be part of it. And he was giving, so he made his hair. He come up with a way to make his hair look like Muddy Waters' hair. So then I'm listening to Muddy Waters. I'm like, this is beautiful. And she says, all right, now look at this one table of black kids in the school. Does any of their hair look like Muddy Waters' hair? I said, no, ma'am, it doesn't. She said, why does his hair look like that? She said, because we have to sit in a chair and put these chemicals in our hair to try to look more like the people that are enslaving us. And she said, you know, Paul Mooney has a joke, if your hair is relaxed, white people relax. If your hair is relaxed, they relax. So she said, this is a process that we go through and it stinks. And she's telling me about the physical process of it. And she's not, granted, she hasn't told me that she knows, I know you're dying your hair. I know that's not the real you. And she says, we sit there and it stinks and it smells bad. And you got to, and you sit there for a long time. And what are you thinking about? And then what happens? And then what happens if you leave it alone? And then your secret gets revealed. She said, so Elvis is dying, is changing his hair to look like Muddy Waters, who's changing his hair to look more white and with white supremacist standards of beauty and et cetera. So she said, how are we going to get out of this? How are we going to get out of this? Didn't say, how are we going to get you free from this dumb shit that you got to, forgive me. How are we going to get you out of this? How are we going to free you, son? She said, how are we going to get out of this? So then she puts James Brown, say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud. Go home and listen to this. So I go home and like, pow. She said, you know, there was a time when we used to do all of that, and then we cut that off and we grew our natural hair. And by doing that, we were symbolizing to the world, but really we were telling ourselves that the real me is the only beautiful me. That beauty is the splendor of truth. That beauty is the outward expression of truth. And that nothing untrue can be beautiful. You're only playing. But every couple weeks, the real you is going to grow out and you're going to have to go get, touch up your new growth. And so she basically gave me the concept of black is beautiful as a way to liberate me. And what I learned from that is, you know, so many things. But what I learned from that is that if I'm ever going to make it, I have to accept myself. And that unless I embrace me, that nobody will ever embrace me, because they won't have the ability to, because I'm not presenting the real me. And further than that, I realized that my mother loved me. She loved me. Wallah, God is my witness. She loved me. She was offering me the best way that she knew. But what I learned is that my mother's experience didn't prepare her to deal with me and what I'm experiencing. What the world gave her, she didn't know what it's like to be, you know, physically unacceptable to a group of people that are the majority. This other woman, this black woman, did understand that. So we write a song about this woman that says, the first day of third grade, topic of discussion at the kickball game is, who's a new student? Why does he look that way? An 8-year-old expert determined I've got AIDS. A vote must have been taken. It became my name. I mean, literally, AIDS is my name, okay? It made its way around the school and eventually heard a teacher tried to catch herself as she yelled it to me. I tried to be invisible, honestly, wishing that the ground would just open up, swallow me. What kind of crime did I commit for this mockery? Guess I must have lost some kind of cosmic lottery. How am I processing this at a baby's age? Felt like I had a gut full of razor blades. I fantasized someone else to come take my place. These people taught me to hate my face. Somebody please pray for me. Imagine how my mama felt. Obviously, she wanna offer me some type of help. Pretty white lady never probably dealt with this particular type of hell. If she dyed my hair blonde, maybe I could blend. Get a better response, maybe even a friend. She took me to the salon, put chemicals in my head. They took the towel off and it was purple in the end. Lot of money spent just to get me presentable. Message that it sent, the real you ain't acceptable. I know what she meant. What else could she expect to do? That was just the lens that she viewed protection through. So eventually, I began to see that the me that grows out of me is my dirty little secret. Had to go back every few weeks to keep it. I think that part depressed me the deepest. Somebody please pray for me. Thank God for the grown-ups. The roll up when they know it's time to hold us. Black women show so much homegrown love. She said, hair doesn't die, but your soul does. She said, Elvis wore his hair in that pompadour because he was trying to look like Muddy Waters more. But he was frying his crown so that he could lay it down like a white man. They called that a conk before. Till James Brown came, kicked down the door. Say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud, my boy. That's the meaning behind the afros and all. Get free being what it is that you know you are. She said, beauty's the splendor of truth. You'll never cut loose till you're suitable to you. Your living is the proof. Just let it do what it do. Then watch them follow suit and try to catch up to you. Somebody must have prayed for me. Yeah. So then you start to grow out from that. And I say, okay, if this woman has this ability, and this school set, or this set of tools that really can free me and can really liberate. It's not just her, but she's part of a tradition. She's part of a community. This is something that most people's grandmothers have the ability to do. I say that just to really kind of echo the spirit of love. this relationship that I had led me to really into music. As a little kid, after this experience of being trained by this woman who trained me with sayings, she really gave me the keys to life in sayings. And you know that Black grandmothers have sayings that you can use the rest of your life. And if you go to college, you can get 12 PhDs and nothing will be as powerful as what grandma says. And this is true of all grandmothers. You know, my particular experience was with Black women and grandmothers. See, they used to say things like, life's not a popularity contest. Jesus only had 12 friends. If you got one, you're lucky. She used to tell me, fix your face. And to this day, I stand in the mirror like, how does one fix one's face? Because you don't want them to fix it for you. But really, in breaking that down, I realized the times that she would say that to me is that I was in this situation with these children being cruel to me, and she didn't want me to visibly show them that it was hurting and affecting me. So she would say to me, one time she sat with me and she said, these people don't know who they are, which makes them orphans. Think about like how deep this is to say to us, 8-year-old kid, these people are orphans. And when I think about what that means, it's like the modern world and the modern West and the dominator culture, by nature, by necessity, it separates you from ancestry. It separates you from the human family. You have to believe you're better than your grandparents. You can't believe in the idea of humanity and continuity and ancestry and lineage. You have to believe that you're the greatest thing that ever existed. Because the idea of being a human being is not what we value here. It's membership in this particular group. So being a human being means nothing anymore. It's just being part of this group. And so these people, because of that, are orphans. And she said, all they have left is that they think they're better than they think they're better than other people. That's the only meaning that they're attaching to life. And so they can't be better than other people unless they got somebody to be better than. They can't exist on their own. They're utterly and completely dependent on somebody to look down upon. So she said, as long as you keep fulfilling that role for them, you'll always be useful to them. And if you stop believing that, you won't be useful to them anymore. And that's how you really become free and you start to set your own precedent. You start to set your own priorities. That's when you really start being you. So she said, if they hurt you, go in the bathroom and fix your face. And then come out here and put your head high. And she said, and if you need to have a moment like that, do it in private. Come out here. Don't ever let them see how they're affecting you. So then the first people that I ever was friends with were people that were around her, you know, Black kids that were around her, the other people that she was caring for. We shared her in common, that she loved us. And that's all we needed to have in common. And they had jokes, but their jokes were just funny. They weren't meant to dehumanize, demoralize. It was really to cut the tension. That like, we can joke about this thing that we're experiencing so much and so well with such precision. And we can even joke on each other with such a beautiful sense of precision and mastery that I can talk about you, but you'll never be demoralized. You'll never be actually devalued by the way I'm talking about you. You know, so instead of like, you know, the way that the people in the dominant culture would talk about me is like, you, your dad and your mom are probably brother and sister. Ha, ha, ha. Damn it. You know, whereas with my friends, you know, I would be getting at them. You look like those shoes. The train ran over your shoes or something, you know, something like that. Man, somebody turn the heat up and melt this snowman. You know what I'm saying? It's just funny. It's just funny. And so I realized that my parents, God bless them. You know, my father also died of suicide. My grandfather died of suicide. My mother died of cancer when she was really young. So, you know, my parents, as much as they tried and as much as they did their best, they didn't have these tools. And I realized that my parents, my family, my country weren't experiencing what I was experiencing from my friends. Every time I see people that look like my friends on TV, why are they always animals? Why are they always one-dimensional when I know they're deep and complex and beautiful and complicated? You know, how come they're always either sexual objects or objects to be feared? Why is it always sex and fear? or they got to be clowns all the time. You know, as much as I love all these cultural figures, I'm always have tension with them. Much as I love Martin, I always know my cousins are watching this, and what are they coming away with? Because it's not what's going to save them the way it saved me. And so with hip hop, I'm thinking, okay, this is going to be the one chance for my blood family to experience the family that God gave me in a very true way. And so, you know, I went into this music really wanting to connect with the legacy of it and the meaning of it and the intention of it. And, you know, God has been very good in connecting me to those people. In the Islamic tradition, we have the idea, what they call it is isnad, which basically means that something as valuable as the nature of reality and the way to purify the heart and the way to live and be with each other. We talk about these three dimensions. In the Islamic tradition, we have that. You've heard about the Sharia, the creeping Sharia law. The Sharia is basically a way to determine my ways of interacting with you, which things are obligations, which things are very good to do with each other, which things are morally neutral, which things are disliked, and which things will absolutely never be tolerated. It's just a way of understanding that. It's a science. And then we also have a science of theology of learning the nature of reality. So what's the nature of a human being? What does a human being really mean, aside from just being a body? And then we also have a science that they call tasawwuf or Sufism. You all know about Sufism and Rumi. You know what I'm saying? That Beyonce and Jay just named their baby Rumi, right? Rumi is the master of the hearts. Rumi is the sheikh of all the hearts, the guru of all hearts, you know. There's a science of how to get the heart right, how to actually grow the heart into one that can love everybody exactly where they are, exactly how they are, with no filters and with no trouble at all. We're talking about unconditional love, how to really just be a personification of love. May God make us all personifications of love. So, you know, these things are given best when they have a chain. When you actually have a transformed human being that's transformed by the beauty and wisdom of the tradition, who sits with somebody who's looking to become transformed, who's looking to experience that growth, and actually go through that process with them and really guide them through that. So I've been very blessed. There's a part of me that's bragging. I just want to say that there's like, my ego really likes saying these things. So maybe I shouldn't say their names, but I'm going to. And so forgive me. If you see something funny in me, just pray for me, okay, and be patient. But so the people that I looked up to the most and loved the most were Chuck D, KRS-One, Rakim. To me, these are like, you know what I'm saying? I don't mean to not put women in that category, because MC Light was also huge. Queen Latifah is also huge. Lauryn Hill, there's nobody like Lauryn Hill in this world. Singular. But like the oneness of God, there's one Lauryn Hill in the world. You know what I'm saying? And of course, she's a culmination of Nina Simone. And of course, she's Nina Simone reborn. And of course, she's Ella Fitzgerald reborn, and et cetera. But so I had the experience when I was 13 where I went and saw KRS-One speak to give a lecture. And at the end, he had written this book, and I asked him to bring me on stage, or I asked him a question. I said, when you're done, will you please sign the book that you wrote? And KRS-One brought me on the stage. And he said, you should read the autobiography of Malcolm X. And, you know, that led me on the spiritual journey. And then later on, when I first came out, Rakim actually brought me on tour with him for a year to be on his tour bus and to be up close and personal with him when he's not on the stage, and to be with his family. And then Chuck D became my primary mentor. And I say all of that, like I said, partially because I like it to say it. But also, like, if you really, really knew me, it makes me feel validated. But also, because of, I'm really saying all that because, or the best reason I'm saying all that is because in a room full of teachers, more than anything is I just want you all to know that you matter a lot. And that everything that's been given to you and put inside of you, you're transmitting it. And I just want y'all to know that there's one kid. I'm the kid. I'm that kid that's out here living life. And if it wasn't for that one person, and I'm going to say something right now that I hate to admit, I don't remember her name. I don't know her name. I never knew her name. Because we didn't say her name in school. They don't say that person's name that much. She was the lunch lady, and she was with me every day. But I know that soul. I can still feel her hand. I can still hear her voice. I still remember her face. I remember what her face looked like when she was displeased with me. I remember what her face looked like when she smiled. I remember what if I would say something that would make her laugh. I remember the way she laughed. I remember the way that when I would become a little stronger and I would actually step out on my own a little bit, I remember the way that her posture would change. Because she just loved me, you know. I think if it's okay, I'll just leave it with that. The human touch can't be replaced. And the fact that we don't always have an award and we don't always have a conference and we don't always have an opportunity to see the effect that we've had on people. We all know that we are who we are because somebody loved us. Like, we know that. And so I'm very grateful to be here.
Yo, we're going to end it like that with episode 31 of the Educated Guest Podcast, Brother Ali. I remember being in the room at that time, and there weren't very many dry eyes.
And if there were, it's because you didn't have a soul, and you're a robot. Piece of shit.
So my takeaway may not be your takeaway, but it's that every adult on campus matters, whether you are the lunch lady, or you're a teacher, or you're a principal.
Everybody, dude. Every interaction is huge. Every interaction creates and helps build the identity or helps detract from it.
You can make their day or break their spirit with a simple conversation. You need to recognize how important you are.
Absolutely. That's the beauty and the curse of the work that we do. You got to be on your game every single day with every single interaction, man. Mm.
And you brought up identity earlier, and I think it's something that we need to say again.
Yeah. This is one of those things where we need to create those safe spaces for our young people to understand their identity, to discover their identity, to be comfortable in their identity, and that self-love. It's a big part that's always overlooked because we feel uncomfortable with it or whatever it is, but we need to do a better job of supporting our young people like that.
And the other thing I took away from this was how the lunch lady presented the information to him about him being beautiful as he is.
Right.
You know, she could have hit him directly straight up with, you're beautiful as you are, but she chose to just provide the context.
Right. And it's, we either give the students, and this is something for all teachers or educators to know and take away, right? We either give them the answers and then they become, you know, there's learned helplessness starts to set in, right? We either give them the answers, or we give them the context and let them grapple with it. And I think the beauty of giving them the context and let them grappling with these ideas and these thoughts and creating that dialogue, it makes them stronger in terms of understanding that content once they have the context, right? And so it's just a testament right there. 30 years later, you could be speaking to a group of educators about your experience. You know what I'm saying?
So true, man. So true. If there's one phrase that I want you to take away from this episode, it's going to be the title of this episode.
Tell me.
Beauty is the splendor of truth.
Boom.
We love y'all. We love the kids. I hope you enjoyed this episode.
Take it easy, y'all. See you next time.